Good evening, and welcome to another adventure in Power Talk. Tonight we have our return guest with us. We have Dr. Phil Fernandez, who is an educator, author, pastor. Phil, welcome back to Power Talk.
Great to be back.
Phil, the first time when we had you on before, we heard your testimony of how you grew up and how you spent time in the Corps and how you came to Jesus and got your education. But I understand that you are very strong in the creation versus evolution presentation.
Yeah. My PhD is in philosophy of religion, so I tend to be more of a philosopher than a theologian. I'm a member of two professional philosophical societies and one theological society. So I'm not a scientist, and I don't claim to be, but I do, like many philosophers and many theologians, I do engage, in dialogue with scientists and with others. And I've debated the issue, does the Christian God exist at Princeton? A major atheist conference I was invited by Paul Kurtz's organization out of Buffalo, New York. He wrote the foreword to Humanist Manifesto number 2. And then he wrote Humanist Manifesto 2000, but I was asked to defend the existence of God in the debate down at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. So it does come up in the dialogues that I have. I usually come at it from a philosophical perspective, but I do a decent amount of reading on the scientific evidence, supposedly for and against, and things of that sort. And in my book, The Goddess is Enthroned, Evidence for God's Existence, the last two chapters are the scientific case against evolution and a scientific case for creation. And I think the order is reversed, but whatever the case, I have done some studies on that, and I have dialogued. I've taken a few debates on the creation versus evolution. But it usually comes up anyway when I deal with debates on God's existence as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are a teacher at King's West High School or schools.
Yeah.
And do you have an opportunity at King's West to enter into this creation versus evolution?
Yeah, it's most of our kids come from Christian homes. So most of our kids are creationist already. A course that I designed from the ground up, I teach a whole slew of different courses. I teach philosophy, world religions, Old Testament survey, New Testament survey, life of Christ, history of Christian thought. But a course that I designed myself was called Christian Worldview, where the first half of the course, we talk about basic Christian beliefs, and the second half of the course, how to defend those beliefs. And that's for 11th graders, because I'm preparing them. About half of our students, it used to be a higher percentage, but right now about half of our students go on to secular colleges. Mm-hmm. And their professors are going to come at them with the atheistic evolutionary worldview. And so I want to prepare them. So we deal with just about every major objection to the Christian faith that's going to be thrown at them at the college level. Right there. In a Christian setting with a Christian teacher in 11th grade, the last course that I have him, Greg Thatcher, great friend of mine, great praise and worship leader, great history teacher, he teaches the 12th grade Bible. So the last chance I get to have one was 11th grade, and we make sure we go over the Christian worldview so they know how to defend the faith. And we do spend about a week talking on creation versus evolution. Mm-hmm. We spend a few weeks talking about it. Evidence for God's existence and dealing with issues like the problem of evil and human suffering and are miracles possible and refuting moral relativism, things of that sort. So I am conversant on issues such as creation versus evolution. And one of the things I try to point out to her, science is something that should be considered very tentative knowledge. Because we make theories or build models on, based on how things appear, what we think that means, and we're not always right. Mm-hmm. And so evolutionists should have much more humility than they do. And I would argue, I think I'd like to go right for the jugular vein, that I call it, but I brought here just a one-page overview of what I lecture on with my students, but the unproven assumptions of evolution. Well, if you just map out the unproven assumptions, what they assume but have never proven, and then you see that many of these assumptions actually violate known scientific laws, which hold more credibility than theories or models, and evolution is just a model. It's not even a scientific theory because you can't observe it now. And to reach a scientific theory, you have to use a scientific method, which starts with observation. And so it's just a scientific model, but basically when you look at what they assume, okay, they assume that either the universe is eternal, which goes against everything that astronomy and cosmology teaches today, that either the universe is eternal, or it had a beginning, but it popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause. When I debated one of America's leading atheists, Dr. Michael Martin, a philosophy professor from Boston University, it was called the Internet Debate, and it's been translated into French and into Spanish. It was a big deal. It was hosted by Internet Infidels, the world's largest atheist website. He came right out and argued that the whole universe popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause, and that's more reasonable than believing that God created the universe out of nothing. And I was telling him, look, we both believe in a miraculous beginning of the universe. But miracles only make sense if you have a miracle-working God. They make no sense if you have a miraculous beginning of the universe without a miracle-working God. Mm-hmm. You know, I tell people nothing is nothing, therefore nothing can do nothing, therefore nothing can cause nothing. So if something had an absolute beginning, something else had to cause it to come into existence. Mm-hmm. If all of nature needs a cause, you've run out of natural causes. You need a supernatural cause for nature. Mm-hmm. So that's the first assumption, that either the universe is eternal or it popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause. Absolutely no scientific evidence for either one of those. Those are assumed. Then the idea that life spontaneously arose from non-life without intelligent intervention. That's assumed. It's not proven. That multi-celled animals came from single-celled animals. Absolutely no. You know, where did a single-celled animal get the genetic information for teeth and hair color? And we're supposed to have evolved from single-celled animals. The scientists might say mutations. Mutations, all they do is they just garble the already existing genetic code. So if the genetic code was like 26 letters of the alphabet, which obviously is much more complex than that, and much more specified than that, if there's a mutation, it only garbles the 26 letters. It doesn't add a 27th, 28th, 29th letter. Yeah. For evolution to occur, you need new information. Mutations just does not do it. And so, I mean, it's just like I tell my students at King's West, we claim to know the who, so we don't have to know the how. And people say, well, how did God create the universe? I don't know. He's infinite in power and wisdom. But I know the who. I know God did it, so I don't have to know the how. If I knew the how, I'd be him. Okay. So, but evolutionists are telling us, well, we don't have to believe in the who because we know the how. Okay. But then we ask them, okay, well, how do we get here? They said evolution. Okay. Well, how did evolution occur? Oh, we don't know. Most of all evolutionists disagree on that one. Well, wait a minute. If you don't know how evolution occurred, you really don't know the how. So evolution is just kind of this. Very convenient word that makes it sound like they know what they're talking about, but they really don't. And so it's assumed that life evolved from non-life, that intelligence came from non-intelligence, multi-celled animals came from single-celled animals, that animals with backbones came from animals without backbones, and that the common ancestry of fish, reptiles, birds, and mammals. All of these things are assumed. They have never been proven. Now, I tell my students, I write all these assumptions on the board, you know, that everything popped into existence out of nothing, totally without a cause, or the universe is eternal. Put all these assumptions on the board and say, if you had to sum up all these assumptions in one word, what would it be? And it takes them about a good 10 or 15 minutes. And they get some pretty weird words that they throw at you, but eventually one of the students will figure out. They look at all these things and they realize, you just described evolution. Every essential stage for evolution to be spelled out is assumed. The only things evolutionists have proven are things that creationists could agree with. So, for instance, they argue for common ancestry. That's not proven, but common design, common anatomy. We all agree that the arm of a man and the arm of an ape and the wing of a bird and the fin of a shark, they do have some things that are in common. Okay? So common anatomy, yeah, evolutionists have proven that, but there's no problem with that from a creationist standpoint. It's just that we say common anatomy proves common design, which proves a common designer. They say, no, it proves common ancestry. Now, when I look at two paintings of Norman Rockwell, I know that I'm looking at two Norman Rockwell paintings because they have a common designer. You start to recognize his work. The evolutionist is saying, no, we should really look at two Norman Rockwell paintings and say, well, this painting at one time looked just like that one and then gradually changed into this one. No, I think common design is much stronger. Now you have the intelligent design movement with great thinkers like William Dembski, who's got a Ph.D. In mathematics and another Ph.D. in philosophy, brilliant young thinker, and showing that the specified complexity, even in a single-celled animal, is enough highly complex genetic information to fill an entire library with volumes of information. You can't get that amount of information by chance, okay? If you got a television set that gets 22 stations and it blows up, a big bang, it blows up, that's not going to give you a 23rd and a 24th station.
Right.
When you scientifically examine random explosions, explosions take things from a state of order and complexity to a state of disorder. You look at the Oklahoma City building after it was bombed. It did not add more design. It brought chaos to what was previously orderly. So, this idea that the Big Bang exploded the universe into existence, that doesn't make sense. Where did that come from? And then the idea that it keeps producing more and more information, which is what specified complexity is, that's just a fairy tale. It's like Dwayne Gish, a great creation scientist from the Institute of Creation Research. He's been debating evolutionists now for decades. But he said, you know, when we say that a frog turns into a prince instantaneously, we call that a fairy tale. But when we say that a frog turns into a prince over a period of hundreds of millions of years, we call that good science. No, we're being sold a bill of goods, and it has consequences as well. Evolution is not proven; it's assumed to be true, and then it's dogmatically crammed down our throats. You know, the evolutionist is real quick to slam Roman Catholics for believing in an infallible pope. They're real quick to slam Protestants for believing in an inerrant Bible. But the fact of the matter is, they expect us to believe in an infallible scientific priesthood. When that is not the case. I wasn't born yesterday, and I used to, you know, when I began to doubt God's existence and became skeptical in my senior year, and I had an atheist teacher that I really respected, Dr. Athanasius at James Caldwell High School in Caldwell, New Jersey, I began to take on, I was somewhere, you know, on a good day I was a theistic evolutionist. If God exists, he used evolution. On a bad day, I was an atheistic evolutionist. And so I had to do some real, you know, looking into the evidence after I got saved. You know, what does this mean with evolution? And what I found with evolutionary theory, I mean, college textbooks. Even when I went to Liberty University, the college textbook for biology, they used an evolutionary textbook. Now obviously, the professor wasn't an evolutionist. But right there in the textbook, it was real interesting, a college textbook, and it stated that the cell theory tells us that the cell is the basic unit of life, and all cells came from pre-existing cells. So you have life coming from life. But then it states, without any proof, after proving the cell theory, then it states, this of course does not apply to the first cell, the first living cell, which had to have evolved from non-living material. No explanation. I mean, they just say, look, this is what we've proven.
Uh-huh.
Of course, this other thing is true. We haven't proven it, and it just violates what we contradicts what we've proven. But we got to be evolutionists here. So we have some infallible high priests right now, but they're from the atheistic evolutionary mindset, and they've taken control of the schools, and they're intolerant in the name of tolerance. They don't want creationists teaching there. They don't want anybody bringing up intelligent design, and that's a shame. Back on intelligent design, now we have Michael Behe from Lehigh, and he showed that the what is called irreducible complexity, that when you get in a subcellular level, Darwin figured everything would be, he assumed everything would be real basic. And so he wrote that. When we get to the cellular, complexity is just a bunch of simple things put together. You get to the subcellular level, and you still have the complexity of a spaceship or a computer, yet Michael Behe says it's irreducibly complex, which basically means even though it's as complex as a spaceship or a computer, if it were any less complex, it wouldn't do the job it needed to do to continue to survive, to evolve into something else.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it had to be created that way. It's like he uses the example of a mousetrap. You remove one part, like the spring or the wood, and it doesn't work. And so for something to survive, survival of the fittest, and to evolve into something else, he finds on a subcellular level these things are irreducibly complex. They couldn't be any more simple, yet they're extremely complex. And so it's like it had to have been created that way from the start.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Behe is not exactly your fundamentalist, evangelical, Bible-banger Christian. He classifies himself as a nominal Roman Catholic, whatever that means, okay? But he's going where the evidence leads,
mm-hmm.
and it leads in the opposite direction that Darwin wanted to take
mm-hmm.
us.
Mm-hmm.
So
the evolutionist is basing everything on things he cannot prove,
mm-hmm.
and has totally negated faith.
Yeah. Both creation and evolution, scientifically speaking, are models. They're mm-hmm. not even scientific theories. Norman Geisler and J. Kirby Anderson do an excellent job on this in their work called Origin Science, where scientific method, which isn't the only scientific way, by the way, to find truth, although most scientists don't know that because they don't even understand the philosophy of science anymore, but scientific method starts with observation, and then you end with a theory, and if the theory is accepted on a universal scale, it becomes scientific law. Evolution and creation, since nobody observed creation, no human observed creation, and no one has observed the supposed evolutionary changes of the past, even evolutionists say, yeah, it's not going on right now, you're not going to be able to look and see it happen in your lifetime,
mm-hmm.
It's not detectable by observation. So therefore, what it is, there are different ways to interpret the scientific data. So it's basically they're scientific models. They're not even part of operation science, the repeatable science of the present processes that are still going on. They're non-repeatable, singular events of the past. And so they're scientific models, ways to interpret the evidence. I think Geisler and J. Kirby Anderson go to great lengths to show that the creation model is much more plausible than the evolution model. You know, I would even argue, my basic thesis is that if evolution is true, you know, evolution needs God, but God doesn't need evolution. If evolution is true, you still need God to bring something from nothing, life from non-life, multi-celled animals from single-celled animals, animals with backbones from animals without backbones, and to, you know, eventually bring men from apes, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All of these jumps violate known scientific data, sometimes even known scientific laws, if evolution is true. So basically you need a superseding of natural laws, which is basically the definition of a miracle. You need a whole bunch of miracles to occur for evolution to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So for evolution, the only way to save evolution is to assume the existence of God, that God used evolution. However, once you assume the existence of God, He could have used evolution, or he could have created the universe in six literal days. But if God chose to use evolution, he covered his tracks, left no evidence of it, so we could charge him with deception, and I don't think you could charge God with deception. And number two, it would have been the most wasteful way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how could God look at his creation after he creates man and say it is good if you have billions upon billions of fossils of dead animals already existing? So I think the fossil record was primarily caused by the global flood. So I'd be classified as a young earth creationist. Many Christians are old earth creationists, and that's great. But I disagree with them, and I think that it's problematic to have death even in the animal kingdom before the fall of mankind. I think God created the universe perfect, that's what the scriptures teach, and so that's why I would side more with the young earth creationists. But whatever the case, the big issue is, does God exist? That's number one. And you throw, by the way, you throw God out the window. In my book, God, Government, and the Road to Tyranny, I use the argumentation of the German atheist Friedrich Nietzsche, and then Christian thinkers C.S. Lewis and Francis Schaeffer, to show that if, you know, Nietzsche argued if God is dead, if God really doesn't exist, then truth is dead, morality is dead, meaning in life is dead. And then Nietzsche, as an atheist, said, now this is going to produce the Superman, the Overman, and bring us to our next stage in the evolution of mankind. That doesn't follow, Nietzsche. That does not follow at all. Now, C.S. Lewis and Francis Schaeffer, C.S. Lewis in his the Abolition of Man, Francis Schaeffer in his work Back to Freedom and Human Dignity, where he talked about the death of man, they realized, without even mentioning Nietzsche, that if God is dead, not only are truth, morality, and meaning dead, but man is dead too.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason why we are now killing babies before they're born, babies who are being born, babies who are deformed after they're born, we're starving to death. Terry Schiavo is not the first person we starved to death in this country. Unfortunately, we've been doing it for over a decade. Even without laws being passed, we have judges just deciding that feeding people intravenously is going beyond the call of duty if the person's handicapped or whatever it may be. And so you have people who are not even terminal, they're not even dying, that have been systematically starved to death. And some of them can speak. I've read one account of a lady begging. Her quote-unquote loved ones were withholding, she couldn't swallow, so she had to be fed intravenously. She was begging the nurses, honey, please give me food.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have thrown out the Creator God, we are now throwing out man. In a world without God, there are no human rights. In a universe without God, human life has no value. And atheists are desperately trying to find some type of value for human life while rejecting God. Just go to the Ivy League schools. Peter Singer, teaching at Princeton, and he's now arguing that we should, you know, if the parents and the doctors want to, we should kill deformed babies after they're born. That disabled people, their lives aren't worth as much as others. And Peter Singer has even put in writing, in his Practical Ethics, that the life of a full-grown pig or chimpanzee is worth more than the life of a newborn baby, human baby. That's a direct consequence of atheistic evolution. And if God is dead, man is dead too.
That's destroying everything that doesn't measure up to their superhuman.
Oh, yeah, Singer goes out of his way every other page explaining how his views are different from the Nazis. So I asked my students at King's West, if every other statement I told you had to explain why my views are different than the Nazis, what would you think? And they say, well, we would think that you have to split some hairs there because your views are very close to the Nazis. Bingo. That's why in Austria and Germany, they refuse, there's too many protests, they refuse to have Peter Singer preaching there because they've seen the gas chambers.
Mm-hmm.
They know where his ideas are leading.
Mm-hmm.
But the guy's got tenure teaching at Princeton, he's making a lot more money than Christian professors are making.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because if you believe what he is preaching, then you don't have to face God.
Yeah, you don't have to face.
Face.
Yeah, and he's also an ethics professor. He's supposed to be trying to figure out what's right and what's wrong. He tries to find how can there be value to human life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's always going to be some man-made definition. And Peter Singer is not a strong-looking man. He's not a former Marine like us. He has skinny arms. I got a friend from Liberty University, from my Liberty University days, Pastor Andre, and he goes around, you know, blowing up hot water bottles. The guy's like a moose, you know.
Yeah.
Wall-to-wall muscle. It's a good thing Pastor Andre is a Christian, because if he were Peter Singer, his definition of what fits into the master race, life worthy of life, you know, might entail a guy with 23-inch biceps. And yeah. I don't fall in that category. So, but Peter Singer's got his own definition and of those who deserve to live and those who don't. Mm-hmm. And if God exists, then all men are created equal. If God exists, all humans are created in God's image, and human life is sacred because we came from our Creator and He created us in His image. If we evolved from slime, you know, we're mere molecules in motion. There are no human rights. And basically, it's going to be whoever controls the universities mm-hmm. is going to control the politics of the future. Whoever has the power, the reins of power, they're going to dictate who lives and who dies, but it's going to be arbitrary. It's going to, we have left God's absolutes in the dust.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's just, don't you think that that's a sign of the times when that we're closely approaching
the end
of God's calendar?
That chapter in God, Government, and the Road to Tyranny, that where I deal with the thought of Nietzsche and all, and I argue for and Lewis and talk about the abolition of man. Lewis predicted in the 1940s, and that the title of that chapter is The Death of Man, The Coming Death of Western Civilization. Mm-hmm. If Western civilization doesn't return to the God who blessed us so abundantly, Western civilization is going to implode. We're going to go down. Lewis said that the few would basically control the billions, and we'd have a race of men without chests, men without moral consciences, who no longer believe in moral absolutes, and the laws would be made not because they're good laws, but because they're laws that are needed to keep those in power in positions of power.
Phil, we ran out of time. We've run out of time. This has been tremendous. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for listening. I hope that you heard. I hope that you learned. And you can see where so many of our schools and our higher education facilities are cheating our students. Good night. I'm Bill Cundiff, and this is Power Talk.